Now we were speaking yesterday about the advances in Christian scholarship under Constantine. And as a D under that, we noticed the great progress made in study of Palestine. The incident I described to you in the story about Constantine's mother's discovery of the true cross shows the nature of the legends that grew up around some of these activities. And just how much is truth and how much is imagination, we cannot say, but it is evidence of the fact that abundantly testified to from other sources that Helena took a great interest in trying to find the places where things in the Bible had occurred, and this stimulated others to activity in the same direction. And so there are many things that are mentioned in the Bible that the tradition as to where they happened, to find the spot in Palestine, we can trace back to this period of the reign of Constantine. There was little interest in it during the previous 300 years, and much upheaval, and naturally a great deal could be forgotten, but still there would be much that could be easily figured out then that would be very difficult to figure now. And just at the end of the hour, I spoke of number 3 in parentheses, Eusebius Onomasticus. And I did not spell onomasticus, but those of you who are at all advanced in Greek, of course, would immediately recognize onoma, a name. And so onomasticus is O-N-O-M-A-S-T-I-C-O-N. O-N-O-M-A-S-T-I-C-O-N. The name book would be an English translation, the onomasticus. And that means geographical name in this particular context. Eusebius, the Bishop of Caesarea, great Christian scholar, by no means a great thinker, but one who covered a great area, one who covered a great deal of material, one who had a precise knowledge of a tremendous amount of facts about Christian history and also about the classical learning. Eusebius was interested in knowing where things happened in Palestine, and so he made a list of places mentioned in the Bible. And then for each of these places that he listed, he tried to find where the place is in Palestine. Now, one advantage that he had that we don't have today is that the Roman roads were there. And while most of the towns had been destroyed, there had been fighting back and forth, a tremendous amount of damage done on various occasions between the certain after Old Testament days, and then to quite an extent also between the time of Christ and the time of Eusebius. Nevertheless, the old Roman roads would still be there. And there would be many things there then that have disappeared since. And so Eusebius tried to find out where the different events took place. A place is mentioned in the Bible. Where was this place? Exactly. He would take any evidence he could find in the Bible and any reference to somebody coming to it from another place or going from it to another place or going up or going down or any reference which would give a suggestion as to the nature of the geographic situation. And so this onomasticon of Eusebius is our earliest work on on Bible geography and is therefore of great importance in Palestinian studies. And there's a further step in it 100 years later for which this laid the groundwork, which we will mention when we discuss St. Jerome. But now we want to go on to capital D. Capital D. We have discussed the reign of Constantine in general. Now we want to speak of a very specific development in church history during the reign of Constantine. One of the most important developments in church history, in all of church history. And this D we call the rise of Arianism and the Council of Nicaea. The rise of Arianism. Arianism is A-R-I-A-N-I-S-M, Arianism. The rise of Arianism and the Council of Nicaea. And so, D here, we will make the first subhead under the rise of Arianism. Number one, the rise of Arianism. And under that, small a, its background. We have noticed how in the 3rd century, there was the great movement of monarchianism. There was the attempt in the Christian church to explain that which we cannot understand. We can gain certain facts from the scripture. But to fully understand them, we need other facts that no man has access to. And therefore, when we try to fit them together, we come into real difficulty. And when people try to explain in a simple way that which involves data and ideas and situations that they have no access to, no way of knowing about, they are very apt to get outside of the area of that which is known to be true. Now, Christians from the very beginning knew that there is only one God. That was very clearly taught in the Old Testament. There is one God in opposition to the many gods of polytheism. There is just one God that exists. But Christians also knew from the very beginning that Jesus Christ is God. And they also knew that Jesus Christ is distinct from the Father. He prayed to the Father. He said, "Not my will, but thy will be done." There are many statements that show us the absolute equality of Jesus Christ with the Father. "He that hath seen me hath seen the Father. How sayest thou then, show us the Father?" He is fully God. He is absolutely equal with the Father. There is only one God. And yet he is distinct from the Father. That is clearly taught in the Scripture. Now, Christians always believed it. And the simple Christian simply accepted these facts as taught in the Bible and perhaps did not think of the possibility of there being contradiction in it. But by 200 A.D., there were those who, in trying to fit these together and to get away from what looked to them like a contradiction, put their emphasis in one side or the other to such an extent that they denied an important part of the truth. We've looked at various phases of monarchianism. That which became most conspicuous was what was known as Sabellianism, the idea that the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are simply modes of the manifestation of the one God. That as the Son shows itself in light, shows itself in heat, shows itself in what we see as we look at it, shows itself in different ways, but it's one Son. There's one God who may manifest itself in many different ways. Now, Christians had little difficulty in recognizing that Sabellianism is not what the Bible teaches. And in their great horror of Sabellianism, their desire to be sure not to fall into this error, some moved in the direction of saying, "No, there is only one God. Jesus Christ is distinct from God." And they made that distinction something that denied the true deity of Jesus. And so you get off to the opposite error. And this perhaps was true of Lucian, the martyr, whom we mentioned briefly, who had been head of the school at Antioch and who was martyred in the great persecution. But in this school at Antioch, there were those who went out who, stressing the difference between Jesus and God, tried to be sure you wouldn't think there was any mere Sabellianism. Jesus Christ, there is the God, the one, the great God, and then there is Jesus Christ. And when they got through, he was not quite God. And one of these men was a man who was quite elderly when the persecution was over. He was a presbyter in the church of Alexandria in Egypt. And his name was Arius, A-R-I-U-S. So we'll speak of him as B, small b, its leader. Its leader. Now, Arius was a good man to be the leader of a movement like this because he was a man who seemed a very serious, sober man, no criticism of his life that anyone could lay his finger on to say he was a bad man, a man who had been an earnest worker in the church for many years, and Arius gave his name to the movement, and he became very active in it. It began when the bishop of Alexandria, Alexander, who had made Arius a presbyter in charge of one of his churches in a suburb of Alexandria, Alexander, in a sermon exalting the deity of Christ, spoke in language which Arius said was Sabellian. And so Arian attacked Alexander. And he gathered a group around him which said, this is wrong. This talking about Jesus the way you do. Said there is one God. And there was a time when Jesus did not exist. Jesus is now God. He is the one who created the world. But God created him first, and then he created the world. He is the greatest of all created beings. He is today a God. God made him a God. God the Father made him God. But he was not originally God. There was a time when he was not. And Arius and another group began criticizing Alexander and began spreading these views. And they, Alexander gave orders that Arius should be excommunicated, that Arius should not be allowed to have fellowship in the work of the church because of his views, which he said were heretical and which he said were interfering with true Christian life and progress. And so Alexander took this attitude toward Arius, but that didn't stop Arius. Arius and others began writing poems in which they set to little jingles and people could sing them in the streets. There was a time when Jesus was not. God the Father created him. He created everything, but he himself was created. And they made up these jingles which people began to sing. And they, instead of talking about you can't take the country out of Salem, they talked about how there was a time when he did not exist. And these were rapidly spread in this way. And soon you had quite a sharp division in the church in Egypt, though the majority in Alexandria were standing with Alexander, who was the bishop at the time, but it spread to other parts of the empire. And in the theater, the pagans began laughing about the divisions of the Christians and ridiculed some of these arguments. And here was Christianity had just gone through this great persecution, come through it triumphantly. The leaders of the empire had to give up the persecution. In fact, the one who was now head of the whole empire was favoring Christianity. And now all this began to spread through the empire, and people were ridiculing Christianity on this basis. And quite naturally, Constantine was very much disturbed about it. And so Constantine wrote a letter which he sent to Alexander and to Arius. And he told them that they should not divide the church over such matters. He told them that he had been anxious for unanimity and peace in the empire, and that he had expected much from Christianity in helping to realize his ideal. He said he'd already been vexed by the new Donatist schism in Africa, and he said, now there's a new discord, and there's no real ground for it. The subjects in dispute are trivial. I offer myself as an arbiter. You, Alexander, ask the opinion of your presbyters on a question of little importance. And you, Arius, have propounded an opinion which you ought never to have held, or at any rate to have uttered. Hence has come this division and fact. I, your fellow servant, urge you to forgive each other equally for the unguarded question and the inconsiderate answer. It's a pity the question was ever raised. No Christianity requires the investigation of such subjects. They arise from the disputatious cavils of ill-employed leaders. Few can understand these difficult matters in which there ought to be mutual tolerance. In reality, you are agreed. Return to your former charity and restore to me my quiet days and tranquil nights, or you will force me to weep and to despair of any personal peace. Your discords alone prevent me from paying a visit to the East. Now, this letter shows as a book I have here written by a professor in the University of Chicago some years ago, The Short History of the Christian Church, says, this curious letter undoubtedly reveals the benevolent yearning of a statesman, but it betrays how little of a philosopher or a theologian the emperor really was. Evidently, he did not know that men who are born to investigate and to think will do so at all hazards. I do believe that what Constantine said is often very true. There are needless squabbles over matters that we do not know the answer to. If something is not clearly stated in the Bible, If the truth is not evidently there, we have had all sorts of divisions in Christian history over matters on which we simply cannot know the answer. And it is very foolish to divide Christians over. On the other hand, there are questions which strike at the very heart of Christianity. Questions which, if decided wrongly, make it impossible for any true thought. And the question always is, in which area does a particular question come? In the end, as we will see later on, the dispute over Arianism reached a point where two words were used as clothing. One word was the Greek word, we'll discuss it in detail later, I just want to mention it in connection with this principle here. One word was the word homoousia, which means the same substance. Is Jesus Christ the same substance as the Father? The other word was homoousia, a similar substance. Is he a similar substance to the Father? There's a difference of one little Greek iota. And Crude, the English historian, in his Life of Thomas Carlyle, his close friend, tells how Thomas Carlyle, toward the end of his life, said to Crude, he said, "When I was a young man, I used to ridicule the Christian church being divided into two parts over one little Greek letter, the difference between homoousia and homoiousia. I used to think that was the silliest thing that ever happened. But," he said, "now as I have looked into things more, as I have had years of study of the matter and see more of developments in history," he said, "I see that if the homoiousia view had run out, Christianity would have disappeared more than 1,000 years ago." That's what Thomas Carlyle said toward the end of his life. As to the difference between his attitude then about this controversy and his attitude in his early life when he ridiculed the conflict over one little letter. Now, of course, it's important that we realize that it isn't to say that one little letter is always important or that one little letter is never important. It depends on the issue involved. If I say I will come now or I will come immediately, between the two words now and immediately, there is not a great difference. There is a little difference. But if I say I will now come or if I say I will not come, there's just one little letter difference. But the difference between now and not is 1,000 times greater than the difference between now and immediately. So in this case, the Christian church had to face this matter and had to make a decision which Carlyle seemed to look upon as having been a tremendously important decision. Constantine soon saw that the thing was not quieting down. It was getting worse. The Arians were spreading their views more widely, and there were people who were strongly opposing them. And the pagans were ridiculing the Christians over this. And Constantine said, "We must find some way of solving this problem right." Constantine said, "I don't know about the matter." He said, "I don't look to me like just a tiny squabble over words, but with the amount of excitement that these people are having over it, I see there must be much more concern than that." He said, "Let's get all the Christian leaders together, have them talk it over, go into it fully, and reach a decision about the matter." And so Constantine said, "We will call a general council of the bishops of the Christian church throughout the empire. We will even invite empires from barbarian areas outside the empire, wherever there are Christian churches. We will invite all bishops of Christian churches to come to a great council to discuss this matter, to decide what the truth is upon the matter." And so Constantine sent out a call for a general council. Now they were having councils of the bishops in different areas from time to time. The bishops from a whole country or a whole province would come together in council from time to time. But this was the first time after Acts 15, as far as we know, that an attempt was made to gather the Christian leaders of the whole world into one council. And so they called it a general council or an ecumenical council. Now, the word oikomenes was a word used for the whole Roman Empire. It was used for the inhabited world sometimes. It refers to human organizations that ordinarily used in a secular connection. But here, Constantine wanted the Christians from the whole oikomenes, from the whole established Roman world, and also from those outside the empire, to come together and to decide what is the truth on this matter and to reach a unity upon it. And so he sent out a call for a general or ecumenical council. Now, in the course of the next 150 years, there were four councils held which have been recognized since as ecumenical councils. The Roman Catholic Church will today speak of 22 or 23, I forget the exact number, of ecumenical councils or general councils which they say have been held. Some of these councils have been recognized by some denominations, some by others. But the first four have been recognized by just about every Christian group. There is hardly an established denomination which has taken any position on Christian history, which has not taken the position that the first four councils, at least, particularly these four, were meetings at which great Christian leaders came together and reached a unanimity on great principles of the Christian religion, which established Christian denominations today, however they might differ on other matters, would agree as having been a true statement of the scriptural teaching by these four great councils. Before we moved the seminary up here while we were down in Wilmington, somebody down there, some very pious Roman Catholic, I believe, got the name of some Protestant ministers and sent them copies of the religious section of a popular Roman Catholic paper called Our Sunday Visitor. And one of them came to me. And I looked into it and was much interested to see a section of questions and answers. And the question was asked, what is the relation of an ecumenical council to the Pope, which has the authority? And the answer given was, every one of the great ecumenical councils was called by a pope. At every one of them, a pope presided. In every case, a pope gave the authority to the decision of the council. Now, that statement was made in this popular Roman Catholic paper. It would be interesting, though, to look at a scholarly Roman Catholic work. Look at the encyclopedia, for instance, the Catholic Encyclopedia. Look up each of these councils. Look up who called it. And no one of these first four was called by any bishop of Rome. Look up who presided, and no bishop of Rome was even present at any one of these first four ecumenical councils. And as to their having had any feeling that their authority would be in any way increased by whether the bishop of Rome agreed with them or not, there is no evidence of any such attitude on the part of any one of these councils. It is true that the fourth one received a statement from the bishop of Rome who had opposed its being called, opposed their having such a council, and was not present at it, but who was a very good theologian. He wrote a statement which he sent to them and which was so excellently written that they adopted it. And so Pope Leo the Great had great influence on the precise formula adopted by the fourth of these councils, but he was not personally present, did not preside, had not called the meeting. And no bishop of Rome has any connection to speak of with any of the first three, and there's only that much with the fourth. But now it was Constantine who called this, and it was usually a Roman emperor who called these early councils. So now we look at number two. The Council of Nicaea. The Council of Nicaea, N-I-C-E-A. There's a little Turkish village in Asia Minor called Isthmus. Just a small village. You see, Isthmus is derived from the word Nicaea. It is just a little village today. But at this time, there was a rather important town there. There was sufficient accommodation. It was a good place. Then the whole such a meeting. And so, as small a, the calling also comes. Constantine sent the word out, sent out definite messages to every bishop whose name he could secure, all through the Roman Empire, and to any of whom he was aware outside the empire, inviting them to come to this meeting. He gave orders that their transportation was to be provided by the empire to bring them to the meeting. They were to be given accommodation while at the meeting. He made it as easy as possible for the bishops to get to the meeting. And the bishops began to come from all over the empire, although the great bulk came from the eastern part of the empire. There were around 300 from the eastern half of the empire and only about 9 from the western half of the empire. The bishop of Rome, who was quite an elderly man at this time, sent 2 presbyters to the meeting. The most prominent Western bishop at the meeting was Bishop Hosius of Cordova in Spain, H-O-S-I-U-S, a good friend of Constantine, a man whose advice Constantine frequently asked on vital matters. And Hosius may have presided at some of the sessions, probably did, although Constantine himself presided at a good many of the meetings. Well, the calling of the council, small a, then b, small b, the deliberation of the council. There were a number of matters that the council wished to consider, but the council would never have been called if it were not for this one great matter of the decision regarding Arianism. That was the great matter on which it was necessary to reach a decision. That was the primary purpose of their council. They had a great meeting with a banquet which was given them by Constantine. Eusebius wrote a fulsome description of it. He said it was like Christ surrounded by his saints, to see Constantine there with the bishops all around him. And of course, this is one thing that makes it hard for a man in a position like Constantine to think things out right, is the flattery that so many men around will give. But Constantine, I think, deserves great credit for his the way he handled this council. He was very careful to leave the bishops absolutely free to make their decisions as seemed to them to be right, and simply to do what was necessary to get them together, to urge them to move forward, to do something, to study the matter carefully and reach a conclusion that would be satisfactory to them. And so after he had the council well started, he turned over the presiding position to Hosius of Cordova. One of the Roman Catholic books says he presided as representative of the Bishop of Rome. But there's no evidence anywhere that he ever thought of himself in that way, or that the Bishop of Rome ever thought of him as in any way his representative. He was a good friend of Constantine, and he was an outstanding Christian leader. But when they began their deliberations and this matter of Arianism was presented, a creed was then presented to the council by a man named Eusebius, a different Eusebius. There were 2 Eusebius at this time. Eusebius, the great church historian, was the bishop of Caesarea. This was Eusebius, the bishop of Nicomedia. Nicomedia was the town in Asia Minor where Diocletian had had his capital. It was an important town in the empire at this time. There was no one there from Constantinople. Constantinople was not even established until 5 years after this time. But Eusebius of Nicomedia presented a creed which 15 of the bishops signed, which was a definitely Arian creed, which said that Jesus Christ, who had created the world, he was the now the great God. Today he had been made equal with the Father, but there was a time when he was not, before God had created him. And this creed was presented, and these 15 voted for it, and 300 or so were positively opposed to it. Now, there were really 3 parties in the council, you might say. Well, on almost any issue like this, in any meeting, particularly when it's fairly new, there are apt to be 3 similar parties to those. That is to say, there was the Arian party. There was a small group which felt this was very important to get this idea across of what Arius stood for. And then there was a small group which felt as this is a terrible mess, and we must in some way get it cleared up so that it will be absolutely clear to the Christian church that Arius' views are completely false. And this group felt that this is a tremendously important matter. That was a comparatively small group at this time. But then what some folks will speak of as the third group is really just the great bulk of the body who were good Christian people, anxious to follow the scripture, but not greatly convinced of the extreme importance of the matters at issue, and anxious to do what was right, but not extremely sure of what it was. And when they heard the Arian creed put in clear, definite language, they knew right away that was not what they believed, and they voted that down overwhelmingly. Well, then, the Eusebius of Caesarea presented a creed, and what he presented was a very good creed. It was a creed, he said, which had been used in his church for many years. It spoke of Jesus Christ as very God, a very God, creator of the world, spoke very, very strongly about Christ, brought out the great central features of salvation, of our redemption through Christ, and it was a very good creed. And most of the people at the council immediately said, that is an excellent creed. Why not just pass that creed and we're all agreed that is what we should stand for? It was a very excellent creed. And so they asked how many are willing to approve of this creed and to sign it, and just about everybody at the council did. And Constantine thought, well, now this is wonderful. They all are agreed. But the little group that was awake to the menace of Arianism saw that the acceptance of that creed was no answer to the problem, because the Arians raised no objection to that creed whatever. And so they said, we don't know how they can honestly do it, but evidently they think they can. And they think they can say Jesus Christ is very God, a very God, creator of the universe, and sign all these wonderful statements. And then they can go back and teach the same teachings as they were teaching before. And they said those teachings, which the council overwhelmingly rejected, refused to adopt, that there was a time when he was not, and that he is similar to God and was created by God the Father and made God by God the Father. Those statements, they said, strike at the very center of our great central doctrine of the deity of Christ. And they said, if these men who hold those beliefs and presented them to the council and want them adopted, and who evidently are going to go right on teaching them, if they're ready to sign this creed, they said, this creed is not a sufficient answer to the problem. What can we do about it? Now, some others thought these were just a little group of troublemakers. And you always, in any situation like that, have to examine it carefully and find out. Are they a little group of troublemakers who are making a big fuss over some very minor issue or over some issue on which the scripture is not clear? That is something we want to avoid. We want to keep away from any such thing and see if that is what is involved. Or, on the other hand, are they people who see the real situation more clearly than the bulk of the people here see it? And will realize that the very center of Christianity is at stake in this attitude of the Arians, and that it is necessary that a statement be adopted by the council which will definitely reject the view that they have been taking. And so when the Eusebius of Nicomedia said, well, of course, nobody believes that Jesus Christ is the same substance as the Father, well, when he made that statement, some of the enemies of the Arians said, there's the word exactly, the same substance. The others said, that's Sabellianism. If you say Jesus is the same substance as the Father, they said, no, it isn't Sabellianism. Sabellianism is, here's the one God who manifests himself this way, this way, this way, this way, just various modes of manifestation. We don't believe that at all, of course. We believe definitely in the distinction between God the Son and God the Father. But we believe there is one God, and that while this distinction has existed from all eternity, there is only one God and Jesus Christ is the same substance as God the Father. And so they took the creed that Eusebius of Caesarea had proposed, and they made a few changes here and there to make the emphasis on the deity of Christ a little stronger. But the one change they made that really was opposed by the Arians was they put in this word, homoousios. Yes? Yes, this was Eusebius of Caesarea that made this group. Eusebius of Nicomedia is the one of the leaders of the Arians. Eusebius of Caesarea is the church historian who tried to keep out of the controversy and tried to give a creed that would please everybody. Yes? He was Bishop of Caesarea, yes. And he was offered the position along the life of Bishop of Antioch, the second largest city in the empire, but he refused it because he wanted to stick to his scholarly studies. Yes?
Now, Eusebius then said that Jesus was not the same
thing. Eusebius of Nicomedia. Nicomedes, yes. Now, when you say Eusebius with nothing with it, we mean Eusebius of Caesarea, because he, I don't mean I necessarily, I may misspeak myself, and I'm glad if you call attention if I do, because it's easy to get confused. But I mean in writings on church history. If you refer to Eusebius, you refer to Eusebius of Caesarea, because he is one of the great authorities in early church history, is Eusebius of Caesarea. His onomastica, his church history, his scholarly activities, his closeness to Constantine, who often took him as a great advisor in many things, make Eusebius of Caesarea an outstanding figure. But in the Arian controversy, Eusebius of Caesarea wanted to keep out of it. Eusebius of Nicomedia is one of the top leaders on the Arian side. And Nicomedia was a very important town at this time. He was a very prominent man. All through this church, yes? I expect Arius was at the council, but being a presbyter, not a bishop, he would not have authority to speak. He was unless introduced by someone else. They were referring to it by his name, blaming him for it all, but he was not outstanding as an individual participant in the council. I imagine he was present, but I'm not sure of that. But Alexander, the bishop of Alexandria, was the leader of those against Arius. But it so happened that Alexander had with him a young archdeacon, not yet a presbyter, but the head deacon of his church in Alexandria, was a young fellow in his early 20s named Athanasius. And since he was with Alexander, and Alexander presented him as his spokesman at many points in the conference and in the discussion with other people, this young man was recognized as a brilliant young man whose ideas were worthy of great attention. Alexander had become interested in this young man. Athanasius, a few years before, had taken him into his household, had trained him, had made him deacon, and then archdeacon in his church. And Athanasius was recognized, despite his extreme youth, as perhaps the leading spokesman at the council for the group that was opposing Arius. In later years, Athanasius was one of the outstanding figures in the church. But as yet now, he was just a young man helping Bishop Alexander. Well, they proposed this homoousios, and the Arians, of course, said that is very terrible. But the Arians had been completely voted down on what they wanted. The great central body of the council, probably 3/4 of the members, said, well, they said, this is kind of extreme to put in the word homoousios. We don't see the necessity of that. We say he's very God of very God, created all things and so on. But they said we don't see any harm in it. And it certainly is a lot nearer what we believe than what the Arians had presented in their creed that was voted down. They said it's a pretty good statement. And so there was only opposition from this little group to this, while most of the council had opposed the Arians creed. And so the result was that Constantine said, well, can't you get together on some statement that we can say that will give unity within the church? And they said, let's take a vote on this newly suggested creed, Eusebius of Caesarea's household church creed, revised in just a few places to stress more greatly the deity of Christ, just a few phrases, but having also this one word inserted. So we will make, under two here, we will make small c, the Homoousian creed. We'll call it that after this one word in it, Homoousian, which was the word that the Arians so disliked. Well, some bishops may have left by this time, left the council. There were comparatively few that would vote against it. Practically everybody present voted for this council. And so the creed was accepted by practically the whole council. And Constantine said, well, this is wonderful. Now you have a statement that you feel represents what the Bible teaches, what true Christianity is, what all you Christian bishops can agree on. Now let's not have any more discussion or disturbance about this. And he said these few Arian ringleaders, Eusebius of Nicomedia and Arius and a few others, we will exile them. We will order them to go off to distant sections of the empire where their influence will be cut down to practically nothing and where they cannot any longer agitate this matter, and so we will exile these ringleaders, and we will hope that there will be unity now in the Christian church from this time on. So that was the adoption of the Homoousian Creed. That was C. Now we must just briefly look at small d, other acts of the council. Other acts of the council. And here we will note as number one, the Easter controversy. The Easter controversy. Gradually, in the previous century, those who wanted to have Easter be not related to the Jewish calendar, not to say the 24th of Nisan is when we remember the death of Christ and the resurrection a couple of days after, but we will say that regulated by the springtime, they had gradually won more and more acceptance throughout the empire. And so the bishops in the council voted that from this time on, it shall be our practice to observe Easter on the first Sunday after the first full moon after the vernal equinox. So anybody can simply measure the length of the day. And when you get the day and night exactly the same length, in other words, March 21st, then look at the moon and see when the full moon comes, and then the next Sunday will be Easter. So it's a simple method that anybody can tell just when Easter is. But it may not be easy to tell in advance just when it's going to be by. So there was a little problem. So, and you remember perhaps that Hippolytus on that bishop's chair that was discovered from about 200 A.D., that on the side of it, there was his reckoning of the date of Easter, according to this system, for the next 50 years. Well, they said, we want unanimity on the day we'll celebrate Easter. So they said, the Pope of Alexandria shall determine the date of Easter and shall send out word throughout the empire as to when Easter is to be. Now, the Bishop of Alexandria had come quite generally to be called the Pope of Alexandria. And during this next 50 years, if the Bishop of Rome writes a letter to the Bishop of Alexandria, he usually addresses it to the Pope of Alexandria. No modern Bishop of Rome would use such terminology of anyone but himself. But that was the terminology used at that time. Of course, the word Pope simply is a form of the word father, and it recognized the leadership of the bishop of this great Christian group in Alexandria, one of the most advanced, most learned cities in the whole empire. A large city at the northern end of Egypt. So that the Easter controversy then was determined, the date of Easter was determined, and the Bishop of Alexandria was to send out information as to what the date was, establishing it by this simple formula. Then number two is the Number two is the Donatists. The Donatists too. And the council said that the Donatists in Africa should come back to their relation with the majority of the church in North Africa. They should reunite with them and become part of one church. But the Donatists refused to have anything to do with them. They said they have a bishop who has been, their bishop Cecilian, who was at the council of Nicaea. They said he was installed, a consecrated bishop, by a man who'd been a tribunal. So he's not really a bishop. And they insisted on their views, and so for the next century, there were two churches in North Africa. And the Donatists held to the views that the Orthodox party held to here. There is no heresy we know of among the Donatists, but they definitely separated from the bulk of the church in North Africa. And then third is the Meletian system. Meletius, M-E-L-E-T-I-U-S, was a bishop in Egypt who, during the time of the persecution, had stepped in and tried to administer in the place of the bishop of Alexandria, who was at that time in prison, unable to do anything. And he had appointed bishops for various towns. And whether he just stepped in to help out in the situation or whether he saw a chance to advance himself, we don't know. But he certainly went beyond what the necessities of the situation required. So there was a large group in Egypt of Meletian bishops who claimed they were the true bishops, and many a town had two men who claimed to be bishops. And so the council said, the bishops who are in communication with Alexander, they are the Catholic bishops in Egypt. They shall be the bishops in each town. But they said the Meletian bishop is invited to become an associate. And the two will direct the work in each town together, and whichever of them dies first, the other will succeed him. And this way, the schism was supposed to be ended. But most of the Meletians did not agree to it. But this was the effort to end the Meletian schism. Now, at the council, there was a group which said the council should take action to declare that presbyters and bishops should not marry, that there should be celibacy of the clergy. But a man who himself had not married, a man who lived on very little food, who lived a very ascetic life, and who people who thought that the ministry should not marry would be apt to think of as a great hero and a representative of their ideas. He stood up and gave a great talk at the meeting, at which he said this was unnatural and contrary to Christians, to the teaching of the Bible, which gives the relation of husband and wife as an example of the relation of Christ and the church, and that no such action should be taken, and no such action was taken by the Council of Nicaea. It refused to take an action opposing the marriage of the minister. Now, to this day, in the Greek Orthodox Church, the lower clergy may be married, but the bishops do not marry in the Greek Church to this day, while in the Roman Church, as time went on, they more and more they moved away from having a married clergy, until in the Middle Ages it became a law that none of the clergy should be married. But this was not an action of the council. It was an action they refused to take. But I think it's an important thing to be aware of. Now, number three. Number three, the Arian controversy. See, number two was the Council of Nicaea. Number three, the Arian controversy to the death of Constantine. The Council of Nicaea was in 325. Constantine died in 337. There are 12 more years of the life of Constantine. Constantine thought the Arian controversy was ended. Actually, it was only begun. A wonderful statement had been adopted, a wonderful creed. And the council had overwhelmingly voted. In fact, practically everybody had signed the creed. And these few Arian leaders had been exiled. But The Arians included some pretty clever politicians and some men who were started in to work things around to get themselves into a different situation. And before we speak of what they did, we will mention, small a, the work of assassination. 3 years after the consul, in 328, Alexander died. And he expressed the hope to all his people that they would elect the young man, Athanasius, as bishop, as his successor. And everyone recognized the great ability of this young man. And so Athanasius was elected bishop of Alexandria. He became the Pope of Alexandria, the man who had the authority to determine the date of Easter for the whole Christian world. And Athanasius, already in his early 20s, had written a work against paganism and a work on the deity of Christ, which had shown rare theological understanding and clearness of expression. Now Athanasius proceeded to take leadership of those who wanted to stress the full deity of Christ. And he wrote extensively on the biblical evidence for it. And his work came more and more to have a very wide influence. And when Constantine said, this Arianism has been voted down by the council, it should be excluded from the Christian church, people should be stopped from any such teaching, Athanasius wrote to Constantine, and he said, matters like this should be determined by presentation of evidence and discussion, not by imperial orders or the use of force. And he urged that the terrible results of Arianism, as he saw them, should be defeated and destroyed, not by imperial force, but by those who understood the issues, writing and speaking and presenting it clearly so that people would understand what was involved. But then Athanasius proceeded as a bishop here of a large church, the city of Athanasia, of Alexandria, with its suburbs, many churches in it under his general direction. He was a great preacher, a great administrator. He was a very able man and extremely active in his work there and in general oversight of the church in Egypt and in consultation with people from other areas. And the Arians decided, we must undermine Athanasius' influence and get him banned, which they succeeded in doing shortly before the death of Constantine. So we'll have to wait for tomorrow to see that.